other day, the state of Connecticut ratified the so-called Equal Rights Amendment, bringing at that point the total to 28 states out of the 38 required to graft the amendment onto the Constitution. The count would have risen to 29, except that on the same day, the state of Nebraska voted to rescind its previous approval of ERA, as the Women's Right Amendment is usually referred to. And therein hangs a tale. The legislature in Nebraska was not reacting to opposition to ERA mobilized by sexist males, but by women, many of whom on second blush are discovering in the amendment implications they regard as inimical to the best interests of American women. The national chairman of the movement to stop ERA is Mrs. Phyllis Schlafly, who is here today and raring to go. Mrs. Schlafly is a graduate of Washington University in St. Louis with a graduate degree from Radcliffe. She is the mother of six children and author of several books, a former vice president of the National Federation of Republican Women, and a national chairman of the United States Bicentennial Committee. Dr. Ann Scott is vice president for legislation for the National Organization of Women, which is ardently committed to ERA. Mrs. Scott is a writer who took a doctorate at the University of Seattle studying Shakespeare. She was a consultant in 1971 to the Secretary of Labor on women's affairs and has acted as a voluntary lobbyist for all legislation dealing with women's rights.
With the National Organization for Women, we're an organization of men and women dedicated to bringing women into the mainstream of American life. We do not discriminate
correctly
on the basis of sex.
Thank you. The proposed constitutional amendment passed overwhelmingly by the Senate and the House holds that, quote, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. That doesn't sound particularly subversive, and I would therefore like to begin by asking Mrs. Schlafly to state her principal objection to ERA.
Well, it's the very innocuous wording of the amendment that is the reason why many people didn't realize in the beginning what unfortunate consequences it would have. But fortunately, the amending process calls for a full-blown debate in the state legislatures around the country, and this is where we find out some of the things that were not originally realized by many people who voted for it. We find, as we look into the matter, that ERA won't give women anything which they haven't already got or have a way of getting. But on the other hand, it will take away from women some of the most important rights and benefits and exemptions we now have.
What would be an example of that?
Well, a great glaring example on which there's full agreement between both the proponents and the opponents is the matter of the draft. Women are exempt from the draft. Selective service says only young men of age 18 have to register. But the Equal Rights Amendment will positively make women subject to the draft and on an equal basis with men. Nor could you have a system whereby the women would get all the nice, easy desk jobs and the men get all the fighting jobs. It would have to be equal across the board, in combat, on warships, and all up and down the line.
Do you agree with that, Dr. Scott?
There is no question that if the Equal Rights Amendment is passed, that women would become subject to the draft. However, I think that we have a situation now where the draft is going by the boards. And furthermore, I think the question is not one of the rights of women here, but it is the question of the draft. Clearly, no sane parent would want to see either child, either a son or a daughter, subject to the draft. But if women are to be citizens and citizens are to be subject to the draft, then women should take the responsibilities as well as the rights of citizenship. But it's not simply a question of being subject to the draft. It is also a question of denial of opportunity. There are many situations in which women could benefit from the draft. They already are in the service.
You might become a war hero.
Why not?
Yeah.
A woman did win the Congressional Medal of Honor. The second winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor in the United States was a woman, Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell. Yes.
Interesting. Now, as many of you know, Phyllis Schlafly is no feminist. A simple Google search will reveal her Stop the ERA campaign, which was highly successful in mobilizing conservative forces to stop the Equal Rights Amendment. And her efforts, they span the time the Equal Rights Amendment was sent to the states for ratification, all the way up until 1982, when the amendment fell 3 states short of the 38-state requisite for amending the United States Constitution. Now, the text of the amendment, and you heard the quote, but I'll read the exact proposed text of the Equal Rights Amendment to you just for accuracy here. Particularly, I'll read Section 1, which states, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex," end quote. Now, in reading that statement, it becomes apparent that no men's rights activist can possibly disagree or disavow this simple statement. In fact, it's unequivocally what the men's rights activist should strive for. And I'm supremely confident in saying that anybody that wishes to not have an amendment such as this in the United States Constitution would then be running counterintuitive to the claimed goals of men's rights activism. You simply cannot mount a reasonable defense against putting this language in the constitution of any free nation and also maintain your bona fide MRA status in doing so, because remember that men's rights activism is about equality under the law between the sexes. You either are for equality under the law between the sexes or you aren't. There cannot be an in-between. No ambiguities can be made. The language is simple, concise, and clear. So I want you then to imagine the ramifications of this kind of language being inserted into the highest legal document in the free world, the United States Constitution. Imagine the ramifications of that. Put aside the fact that feminists wanted this amendment in place for their own selfish reasons, and ask yourself, what is the potential for an organized MRA political sphere to point at the new language in the United States Constitution and say that, you know, for example, studies show that men face more jail time on average for committing the same crimes as women, or imagine the original offending issue. Congress cannot, under the Equal Rights Amendment, demand that men are legally forced to sign selective service documents for their right to vote when women don't have to either. The language, again, is clear. No discrimination based on sex. That's what the MRA wants, correct? Now, I shouldn't have to tell you that for the MRAs, it would be immensely conducive to their political needs to have the Constitution specifically state that it cannot discriminate against sex, even if previous amendments already bar discrimination based on race. And even if we argue that these previous amendments are already sufficient, cold hard language inscribed into the Constitution prohibiting sex-based discrimination would be a powerful tool against the propensity for feminists to implement their particularly cherry-picked brand of gender equality. And yet, when push came to shove, the striking down of this amendment came not from feminist interests, but from the conservative traditionalist right. I mean, this interview in particular is remarkable in that, although the feminist debater is, of course, full of bluster and political posturing, I mean, we know feminists don't really actually want to see women have to earn their equality in the front lines any more than traditionalist white knights do. You know, feminism is, after all, female advocacy at all costs. But as far as this feminist goes, the argumentation she expressed is what sounds to me like the ideal men's rights platform in regards to the issue at hand. That is, according to her words, and I'm quoting here, well, probably paraphrasing, you can call it, but I think I'll get the gist here. She says, "The draft is an inherently oppressive institution that should be done away with, but if we are to have it and women want equal rights, then they should be expected to sign up for selective service just like men do. Either do away with selective service or implement equal treatment regardless of gender under the law." Now, I know I'm repeating this a lot, but to reiterate, any question of men's rights can, to essentially a scientific exactitude, be answered by the question, is it against equality under the law between the sexes, or is it for equality under the law between the sexes? This feminist woman, although I don't believe it to be altruistic for a second, phrased her wording exactly along the lines of equality under the law, while Phyllis Schlafly was quoted as saying, quote, that the Equal Rights Amendment won't actually give women anything they don't already have, but will in fact take some of the important rights, benefits, and exemptions that women have had historically, particularly I refer to the draft, end quote. Notice that she said rights, then benefits, then exemptions for being a woman. Now, speaking about cherry-picked equality, we've been led to believe in the men's movement by traditionalist conservatives that the right doesn't look at gender, that they teach that everybody is an individual under the law, that identity politics is a bastion and signature of the left. Why then has it reared its ugly head in the trad-con right for everyone to see once the chance of real equality enshrined into the Constitution makes itself available? Now, let's talk about non-feminism. This purveyor of feminism is the great evil and justice of our time mentality. What says the non-feminist here? I mean, have you looked up from your gnashing of teeth at your Goldensteinian shrine of anti-feminism? Have you looked up yet to notice that while you were indulging in your 10 minutes hate of feminism over and over again, a woman called Phyllis Schlafly, about as non-feminist as they come, mobilized a political reckoning that stopped an amendment to the United States Constitution barring discrimination based on sex. Would you care to explain to me just how the feminists are responsible and to blame for this one? Again, to reiterate, the reason feminists and the National Organization of Women wanted an equal rights amendment to the Constitution was obviously not for the purposes of a true equality between men and women, and certainly not in hopes of furthering any MRA's agenda. But even a first-year law student would be able to tell you that the specificity of the amendment barring discrimination against not men and not women, but on the specific word of sex, would provide a huge opportunity for MRA interests regardless of what the original intent was. We've seen legal precedents used over and over in ways that they were not intended to be, based on some, you know, malleable language in some law. This happens over and over again, and it's happened consistently not only in lesser courts, but in the Supreme Court. The traditionalist shibboleth of protecting women from harm at all costs is responsible for the failure of the Equal Rights Amendment and all of the ensuing opportunities that men will have missed out on henceforth. This should exist as a lesson to us that it's not just feminists who want a special kind of equality when it comes to women, that for all of their talk about libertarian values and for all of their sanctimonious flag-worshipping liberty and freedom for all bullshit, they, meaning traditionalists, are still just as guilty of a desire to have institutionalized privileges for women. They justify it by selling men a plate of pig slop dripping with chivalry and outdated tradition. They cover it up in euphemisms and homemaking and family values. But in the end, telling men that you should face the possibility of getting shot at more than a woman for the same amount of freedoms is no better, and certainly not one iota above the typical feminist brand of jurisprudence that has led us to affirmative action for women, or any other one of the injustices leveled against men under the operating assumption that women should be entitled to extra protections or exemptions simply for being female. Instances like this show us in stark clarity that the white feather campaigns of World War II never did end, and when it comes to liberty and patriotism and good old-fashioned American wholesomeness that people proffer as an antidote to feminism, all of us are indeed equal so long as you understand that some women are more equal than others. Now, I might not be an MRA, but I think it's about time that men's rights activists understand that they have a philosophical obligation to decry the blatantly gynocentric inconsistencies wrapped up in traditionalist doctrines, at least when it comes to the main issue at hand here, which to the MRA is, again, of course, equality between the sexes under the law. If it isn't okay when feminists do it, it shouldn't be any different when traditionalists do it. If these people really had some genuine interest in keeping women out of combat for practical reasons and the safety of male soldiers, then they can simply petition for the end of selective service for both genders instead of seeking to uphold and exempt for men and women respectively. Juxtapositions and clashes of the two great manifestations of Western gynocentrism, these being traditionalism and feminism, are excellent case studies for us to observe and really get down to the bottom of why and how misandry and male disposability are allowed to persist in our society. In many ways, clashes between the two great gynocentrisms of Western civilizations are nothing more than competitive posturing for who will receive the most male utility, and rest assured that no matter who wins, men will have had no say in the matter either way. These ideologies must not be allowed to pass on to the upcoming generations of men and boys, and through, you know, things like hypergamy theory, through an existentialist epistemological breakdown of what it means to be male. Through knowledge of ourselves, we can curb the passage of both these insidious ideologies before they infect another generation of men and boys, and I for one must at least make the attempt, especially for the younger men and boys out there that grew up seeing pro-feminist self-castigation or pro-traditionalist disposability doctrines as the only two options available to them. No more. Let traditionalism die with the traditionalists that let feminism unfold under their watch, by the way. Let the intrinsic curiosity of the youth point out that if their good old days were so golden and so pure, then why, pray tell, did feminism come about in the first place? Let old men ramble on about America and the family unit and so on and so forth, but let the youth strike out and discover something new for themselves. Now, don't get me wrong, many of the MRAs and MGTOW of the older generations understand what we're attempting to do here and fully support us men going our own way, but in the end, it's what we instill in the youth that will either rectify or perpetuate misandry, period, point blank. I mean, we're operating now under what has worked as a guide for what may or may not work in the future. And the fact is that traditionalism relented under the pressure of feminism and has been fighting a losing culture war with it ever since. So it's with that said that I will attempt in this video to identify just what it is we have to do to move forward on the men's rights front and on the cultural front. Particularly, what do we have to start teaching boys so that they don't grow up to be blue pill white knights or male feminists? My suggestions, and that's all they are, suggestions, will revolve around an understanding of and dismantling of the accompanying shibboleths of what I've referred to as the two great gynocentrisms of our time, traditionalism and feminism, and as well as a fuller understanding of what it actually means to be male. So we're going to examine these shibboleths accordingly and try to discredit them for the purposes of allowing men and specifically boys to develop alternate modes of thought and specifically non-gynocentric modes of thought that contribute to male financial and emotional wealth and freedom, what I've referred to previously as male sovereignty. Now, the shibboleths I've mentioned generally have their basis in traditional gender roles but have carried on, you know, rather seamlessly into the fabric of feminism. Feminism will not be portrayed here as some great evil, but as simply as a great revelation, a great exercise in pulling back the curtains and examining what's really going on behind the scenes of this little play we call civilization. We will not get mad at the wrench thrown into the gears for jamming up a machine that we're just discovering was there. We take the wrench out, we watch what happens, we record what happens, and we derive benefit from it. That's all we're going to do here. But before I do present to you these shibboleths to be deconstructed, we have to first ask an important question of biological realities and dependencies that men have. I mean, what predilections are we stuck with as men? The portion of the great Western gynocentrisms that appeals to biology cannot be ignored and should be explored in as much detail and depth as possible. If men are ever to understand themselves honestly and holistically, if the measure that separates man from the apes is the ability to both comprehend and manage his instincts, then we ought to consider it a matter of great importance and even an affirmation of our masculine humanity to explore our biological dependencies on the opposite sex, mitigating and resisting these dependencies when it is of benefit to men and boys, of course. So as such, it becomes necessary to ask ourselves to what degree are phenomena that we've previously discussed before, like, you know, male mother need, entrenched into our biological souls, for lack of better terminology. And in embarking on such a journey, I speculate that we're quite likely to discover some uncomfortable truths about male dependencies on the opposite sex that may make us squirm and, you know, turn away in disgust at just how much we are dependent on the biological idiosyncrasies of the female. But as long as these dependencies remain ineffable, we will continue as men and boys to struggle along in silence with our millennially dispersed addiction as would a heroin addict with no knowledge of the physiological mechanism of action of the opiate on the body and brain chemistry of an addict. Quite frankly, the male-female reproductive process can be classified as a benevolent addiction, one that perpetuates us as a species, but an addiction nonetheless. And it's with that in mind that I cite the famous Hartle's Monkeys study. Now, this is one of my favorite psychological studies of all time. This study has attempted to quantify motherly affection and its role in primate development. Now, what Hartle did was to separate rhesus monkeys at birth from their mothers and provide to them a surrogate mother made of wood and cloth with a unique face that allowed the infant monkeys to identify as their specific mothers. And they were, in fact, shown to prefer their surrogate mother's individual face over all other surrogate mothers. And also, you had a comfort variable that was established. So the surrogate mothers were fixed with a warming mechanism, and the cloth allowed for the grasping of the surrogate mother, which satiated an instinctual biological comfort mechanism for rhesus monkeys. Rhesus monkeys need to clutch and grab as a means of expressing and deriving comfort from their mothers. And, you know, all the videos to the actual videos to these studies are all in the description box for anybody that's interested in watching the various experiments that were conducted. Very interesting study indeed. The only thing that the surrogate mothers weren't equipped with was a nursing bottle, which was equipped to a plain wire mesh surrogate mother instead, without the comfort cloth and the heating mechanism. And this was done to determine which factor took precedence of importance to the infant monkeys. Was it the basic need for sustenance or the basic need for motherly affection?
Mother is a bit of plastic and shaggy cloth. A doll with no life of its own, but capable of nourishing the life of an infant. The monkey will come to depend upon this doll to satisfy basic necessities of life. Not only nourishment, but a deeper psychological need for comfort and security. In primate infants, there is an instinctive need to cling to another body, soft and warm. Food or security, which is motherhood's stronger appeal? Alongside a warm, familiar mother of cloth,
is a stark wire doll set up as nothing more than a feeding machine. A cloth mother which has no milk to nourish him, but fulfills some fundamental needs. This experiment revolves around one simple question. Will the infant monkey switch his affection to a wire mother which offers food and life itself? Forced by hunger, does he loosen his grip and begin to yield to nature's most powerful internal drive. From the wire mother, he derives one thing, nourishment. No warmth, no comfort, no feeling of security. After feeding, he returns to spend up to 22 hours a day near the only mother he knows. From this inanimate object, the infant derives all the security and mother love he needs. He can, if also exposed early to other young, grow into a normal, well-adjusted adult.
So, as you saw, motherly affection was so much more of a priority that the infant rhesus monkey would wait until it was famished to nurse, to venture over to the wire mesh mother and obtain sustenance. And various other tests, one in which motherly affection, the role that motherly affection played on the mitigation of fear was introduced. There was a mechanical, threatening monkey put in front of the infant rhesus monkey. And whether or not the mother was there was what determined whether or not the monkey would actually confront and physically attack and resist the attack of this artificial threat. You know, the fight or flight reflex was contingent on whether or not the mother was present. And in another test, the monkey was thrown into an unfamiliar environment where it was tasked with exploring that unfamiliar environment. And again, the presence of the mother determined whether or not the monkey could successfully explore these unfamiliar environments and learn more about the environment around him or her. So as you can see, motherly affection did in fact play a huge part in whether or not these monkeys successfully navigated their fears of the unknown and unfamiliar. But the part that I thought was the most telling about this experiment was when Harlow introduced the Iron Maiden surrogate mothers, and these were so called in reference to the spiked medieval torture device. It was just this man-shaped coffin-like device that was filled with spikes that someone would walk into. They would close the device, and in doing so, impale the poor soul who was trapped in there. And so with these Iron Maiden surrogate mothers, blasts of ice water and spikes would shoot out of the surrogate mothers in order to simulate abuse. And the fascinating part was that it turned out that even still, the infant monkeys craved comfort so badly. I mean, they needed their mothers so intensively that they still would not let their mothers go, even during these bouts of abuse. They needed to cling to their mother even when they serially abused them. Now, I referenced this study to highlight just how strong the ingrained need for motherly affection can be in a species that shares upward of 94% of our DNA. I cite this study not to definitively prove anything about human nature, but to pose a question about it. And so the question that needs to be asked is, to what degree are human beings, and for our purposes specifically, human boys, beholden to these same maternal needs? And does this also translate later in life to male mother need and courtship? I suspect the answer to this question is paramount to decoding the innermost workings of the male mind. Now, in my video on male mother need and civilizational male draw, I talk of a propensity, specifically in the uneducated, uninitiated blue pill male, to seek solace in the fantasy that there exists somewhere, I'm quoting directly here, that there exists somewhere a kind, caring, exceptionally warm woman that will demand of him only what he demands of her. That is, you know, simple companionship and affection. It's a type of unconditionalism. He seeks the one pure woman who isn't with him for her own biological self-interest. This is what motivates men like Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant. We're talking about men who can literally afford harems, literal harems of fertile, genetically fit women of reproductive age to instead pair up with one woman in marriage and take great financial risk in doing so. It stems from a desire to satiate and negate a weakness within ourselves. It's a struggle to push out the perceived negation of our inherent personhood, our attempt to hide our heads in the sand instead of confronting the fact that the entire universe is quite all right with male suffering. No group of people, you know, not men, not women, or anyone, likes to confront an ingrained inability for its society's penchant for dehumanizing them. Instead of accepting this, we, you know, men, seek an exception that isn't there, and the closest comparison that most men have to a woman that never did judge them on their utility is their mother. So on some subconscious level, we look for a mother within the woman and within the wife. The point of me bringing this up is because for men and boys to truly understand themselves, for them to have any future at all that isn't a perpetuation of some gynocentrism, we need to understand our weakness, our biological predispositions to remain servile to the human female. It's a matter of necessity that we understand this in much greater detail than we do today. Studies need to take place. Accurate conclusions need to be drawn. I'm not going to bore you with some screed about how we just need to stop feminism. Those of you smart enough to see it clearly know that feminism is and always has been a symptom of a much greater affliction. The only cure to this affliction is to understand the primitive animal residing in the male mind and not cage it, not repress it, but to embrace it as a part of us. So, in terms of our biological dependencies on women, we know that young boys and the men they eventually become cannot be cured of this maladaptation. The trait will persist and there's no way we can extricate it. Thus, since it cannot be removed from the male psyche, it must be controlled first by realizing it is there and managing it accordingly. Such is not true, however, for learned behavior, and boys, from the very beginning, are taught things about themselves and about women that simply are not true. Making an appearance on both the great gynocentrisms of traditionalism and feminism are certain Fox truisms that exist in such a way that it will not suffice to simply let boys figure out the placements of the inconsistencies on their own. They must in fact be told, they must be guided and shown the lies as a father would explain to his son some difficult distinction that could only be discerned by an experienced eye. And this is where we can change. This is where the minds of boys are fluid and malleable, and so we have the difficult task of inspecting what I'll call the five monkeys scenario for the human male. Let's first familiarize ourselves with the five monkeys scenario for primates. So,
start with a cage containing five monkeys. Inside the cage, hang a banana on a string and place a set of stairs under it. Before long, a monkey will go to the stairs and start to climb towards the banana. As soon as he touches the stairs, all of the monkeys are sprayed with cold water. After a while, another monkey makes an attempt with the same result. All the monkeys are sprayed with cold water. Pretty soon, none of the monkeys will try to climb the stairs. Now, put away the cold water. Remove one monkey from the cage and replace it with a new one. The new monkey sees the banana and wants to climb the stairs. To his surprise and horror, all of the other monkeys attack him. After another attempt and attack, he knows that if he tries to climb the stairs, he will be assaulted. Next, remove another of the original five monkeys and replace it with a new one. The newcomer goes to the stairs and is attacked. The previous newcomer takes part in the punishment with enthusiasm. Likewise, replace a third original monkey with a new one, then a fourth, then a fifth. Every time the newest monkey takes to the stairs, he is attacked. Most of the monkeys that are beating him have no idea why they were not permitted to climb the stairs or why they are participating in the beating of the newest monkey. After replacing all the original monkeys, none of the remaining monkeys have ever been sprayed with cold water. Nevertheless, no monkey ever again approaches the stairs to try for the banana. Why not? Because as far as they know, that's the way it's always been done around here.
Oh, it becomes then imperative that we ask ourselves, what traditions and customs do we instill into boys? And are we simply perpetuating these traditions because we're vaguely aware of a past that a now defunct tradition or custom once pertained to effectively? In regards to traditionalism, I said in a previous video, quote, men and women are not lovers. We fuck, we make babies, and we set up all sorts of customs and traditions around that. And oftentimes the traditions become so thoroughly ensconced for so long that we forget why they're even there. When we forget why they're there in the first place, we can no longer judge when they cease to be useful. And that is what happened, unfortunately, with traditionalism. We created the lies of romantic love and chivalry because men needed to believe in women being with him because they loved them instead of because they needed them. And when women figured out that they no longer needed men, that they could work for themselves or rely on government to extract wealth from men, that little fantasy was shattered into a billion pieces, almost in a thunderclap. And so here we are, the denizens of Western civilization, the five monkeys who barely remember why we bend down on one knee as though in worship, to propose marriage to some red-blooded woman, offering her to please, please make us the happiest man in the world by allowing us to provide to her a lifetime of sustenance, slaves to our traditionalist shibboleths. So what are these shibboleths? Well, let's start with the homemaker shibboleth. It's up to us to take a long, hard look at gender traditions and ask ourselves whether or not they're still actually useful. If not, we must do away with them. The woman as the homemaker traditionalist shibboleth is responsible for alimony, it's responsible for another shibboleth, the presumption of motherhood, and it's also responsible for the reason that women get custody of children in the vast majority upon divorce. Women, when looking at their traditional gender roles circa 1950-60-ish, no longer saw any reason to adhere to them. They cast them aside and they haven't looked back since. And it's time for us to cast off archaic traditions as well and to reject women and men that seek to bind them to us. If a woman tells you women are naturally more nurturing, tell her that you can be just as nurturing as her and that any woman of yours will be expected to split as extensively as possible the task of child rearing. You want to nurture and watch your children grow up just as much as she does, and if she has a problem with this, then she is inferior stock. Don't breed with inferior stock. Men must be taught to want and demand just as much time in their child's early development, especially for boys, as women do. You can't do that if you're working 70 hours a week because you're trying to be a real man and provide. You understand me? And do not bring children into an environment where one parent is expected to essentially alienate himself because of a cultural norm that expects him to do so, so that the other parent, by virtue of her possession of a vagina, can spend more quality time with that child. I mean, what type of message would that send to your son? Did you ever think about that? I'd imagine that it conveys to him that he is, for some reason, less deserving than the woman he eventually reproduces with to time with his children. What a disgusting message to send to your male progeny. Our society is one in which men are indoctrinated from birth into a hyper-obsession with passing on their genetics. You know, without a doubt, organisms exist to perpetuate themselves and reproduce. Nobody denies this. But boys, specifically, are so bombarded with the pressure to measure themselves based on this genetic rat race that we've lost sight of the bigger picture here. What is it worth to reproduce, to pass on your genetic lineage, to create another human being if, because of the context in which you achieve that reproduction, you can't even instill values and legacy and culture into your children? People that have this, you know, reverence of reproduction as though it's the entire reason for existing are simply base animals worshiping their own instincts. There's much, much more in the bigger picture here. I've come across one troll who will remain unnamed here on YouTube, who I had to ban, that actually brags about paying child support, even though his wife is the one that allows him, keyword allows him, visitation. You know, he doesn't even care because, well, you know, he got to reproduce. Meanwhile, his wife has custody, probably uses his child support money to spend on her new boyfriend. I'm sure his daughter will grow up with some sort of fucked up daddy issues the rest of her life, but congrats, you know, you got to reproduce, so what do you care, right? Not fucking good enough for me. Now, currently, I'm undecided on kids. You know, I know for a fact I don't want any right now. In the future, this may change. Who knows? But one thing I do know is no woman on this planet is going to use my kid as an excuse to sit on her ass and do nothing for the rest of her life, depriving me of quality time with my offspring because I am so beholden to my instincts that I can't realize that if that's how it's going to be, then it's not even worth it to reproduce. And these are the lessons that we need to teach to boys about reproduction. These are the counter traditions to traditionalism that we must, as fathers, begin to instill into our sons especially. This is the informal education that will actually maximize male potential and keep male wealth, health, and prosperity in the hands of the men that actually cultivated and worked for it. Let's talk about the value of homemaking. This is another shibboleth that should be deconstructed and explained thoroughly to men. It amounts essentially to a cultural writ of leisure for the female gender, and has its manifestations, of course, as with all of these things, in the two great gynocentrisms of our time. It cannot be understood enough, it cannot be explained enough, just how much alike feminism and traditionalism are in their stated goal. They differ in practice, but very rarely in purpose. The intention is, of course, who will sustain women and their children? Who will take on the egregious burden of women and children and allow them to live in a life of relative leisure? The question, of course, is rhetorical, since in both the traditional sense and the feminist sense, the answer must always be men. So in traditionalism, we see this mimetic portrayal of the worth of homemaking. But what is homemaking, really? Well, you know, it's a euphemism for the veneration of tasks that a particularly intelligent and well-coached chimpanzee could be taught to do. You know, these are your essential domestic duties that single bachelor men all do while still paying their rent and holding down a job. You know, we're talking about cooking, cleaning, laundry, washing dishes, etc. We're talking about skills that are so fundamentally basic to learn and implement that they can hardly be considered a legitimate form of work, since after all, things like cooking, for a great many men, myself included, are hobbies. Something we do for fun. A credentialed chef running a commercial five-star kitchen is what we would refer to as a professional cook. A stay-at-home mom, whose duties are to clean and to slap together dinner once or twice a day, is really honestly just a loser. And I'll tell men that, but nobody else will, because men are invested in inflating the importance of domestic mediocrity, you know, homemaking and all that. Because after all, if homemaking is just as important as the job you have to do as a man day in and day out to pay the bills, why aren't women willing to do it for men? They won't, they don't. And it's because they know what a joke the comparison between man's work and women's work, traditionally speaking, is. It's an utterly disgraceful, patently false conflation that can only be made because everyone holds it up as an innocent, pretty little lie that shouldn't be breached. And if it were just that, I wouldn't have much of a problem with it, but this belief that women are traditionally inclined to this venerated laziness blends into feminism and provides the catalyst for the welfare moms, the women, infant, and children programs. All that's there because it's assumed by the tenets of traditionalism that women are the default caretakers of young children, and therefore they should be tasked with these incredibly menial, mediocre jobs. You know, I put jobs in the word quotation. That's what homemaking is, essentially. It's women passing off menial domestic duties and child rearing as, you know, hard work, just as hard as what you're doing, an equal contribution. When in reality, it translates directly to less access to children for the fathers in the relationship. Let's talk about male utility. Men and boys must be made to think that their utility is as important as a woman's reproductive ability in the transactional relationship of reproduction. They must be taught to emulate the extreme interest that women take in how they provide their end of the bargain for their end as well. This is to say that boys should be taught to selfishly guard their utility, and that it is in their best interest to maximize the fruits of their labor and view it as an indicator of what we'll call external male virility. Not for the sake of a woman, but for his sake. Boys must be taught that their ability to turn labor into profit, their generally increased propensities for creative thinking and problem-solving skills allow him to even the score in the reproductive tug of war that is always occurring between men and women at all times, forever. The human female's ability to reproduce is an extremely powerful motivator and manipulator of the human male. The one thing that can compete with that power is the male's propensity for honing his competitive utility. Thus, boys must be taught to be as selfish in guarding the fruits of his utility as women are in guarding the fruits of their reproductive ability. Boys should be taught from an early age to pursue and safeguard financial independence by extracting the fruits of their own utility, and it should be instilled into them an almost conditioned desire, almost an entitlement that they should try to at all times minimize the amount of access that women can gain to his utility. In this aspect, boys should be taught that the more selfish they are, the better. Much like girls are taught the same way, you know, wear high heels or makeup or what have you in order to essentially get a higher status or higher value male. Boys must be taught this the same way. We must start cultivating the same things that women did and are continuing to do on a daily basis, you know, in the genetic rat race, for lack of a better word. And so because of this, boys must be educated in the various ways our society is set up to increase the profit margin of its male utility due to the forces of civilizational male draw. Remember, all innovation, all civilizational maintenance is derived in the vast majority by men. society sets up ways, sometimes sensible and ethical, other times insidious and oppressive, for male ingenuity and labor to be extracted. Boys must be schooled thoroughly in which ways they can be disenfranchised for the purposes of these extractions. So, the extraction schemes are as follows. Alimony. Alimony, combined with child support, is the theft of male utility bolstered by the presumption of motherhood shibboleth. And this shibboleth works both in tandem with and predates feminism. We have the presumption of the nurturer as mother, the inviolable Madonna and caregiver providing the impetus for the assumption that children are most able to be comforted by a female figure, and that because of this, it's up to men to acquiesce to an unspoken abdication of his young children in the event of divorce. You know, because it's just the way it is. It's just another allusion to the five monkeys scenario I mentioned earlier. In order to illustrate this, I want to bring your attention to a certain website, and I can't take credit for this. This excellent find actually comes courtesy of A Voice for Men in their recent article titled, I believe, Traditionalists and Their White Knights, which is also in the description box. And there's some excellent rebuttals of traditionalism in the comments section. I suggest all of you go and check that right now. But the site is called Feminine Mystique by a self-professed, get this, traditional woman rights activist. I want to show you this because it just helps so much to put into perspective the pure gynocentrism at the core of traditionalism. Now, I suggest that all MRAs visit this website for the purposes of delving into the thought process of these supposedly pro-male traditionalist women. But specifically, get a good look at the stated goals listed for a would-be traditional woman rights activist. You know, the stated goals of their intended activism. Goal 1. Make it the sole obligation of the husband to support his wife and children as long as the wife remains faithful. Goal 2. Protect mothers of young children and protect children by reinstating the tender years doctrine. Now, just as a caveat here, the tender years doctrine is given by Wikipedia as follows. Quote, the tender years doctrine is a legal principle which has existed in family law since the late 19th century. This common law doctrine presumes that during a child's, quote, tender years, generally regarded as the age of 13 and under, the mother should have custody of the child by default, end quote. So it's pretty straightforward. These people wish to cement a woman's status as default caretakers of young children. It's really no different than women getting custody in the vast majority of divorces based on the mere assumption that their genitalia renders them better parents, and it eventually reduces to the fact that women have for millennia felt entitled to control men via their children. It's nothing new here, folks. Goal number 3, to protect the woman by making her exempt from her husband's debt, especially if she should become widowed or divorced. Now, she doesn't specify this, but I seriously doubt that the vice versa in this scenario would be encouraged by this traditional women's rights activist. Stated goal number 4. Repeal no-fault divorce laws and reinstate alimony for ex-wives only to give security to women who opt out of the workforce to raise their children or help their husbands. So, of course, you know, we are conditioned in the men's rights movement to believe that alimony is a feminist invention. But in reality, it is these type of women, these traditionalist women, that seek to safeguard themselves at the expense of men. And of course, divorces happen, and divorces will happen, and men will get tired of their wives, and women will get tired of their husbands, and people will split, and people are just incompatible sometimes. But you know, this runs counterintuitive to the meme that has been expressed in the men's rights movement over and over again, that it is the left only that perpetuates these identity politics, where the heavy hand of the state should be used, the coercive hand of the state should be used to extract monies from men in the event of divorce. This is pure identity politics here. The next stated goal, reinstate family wage laws. The next stated goal, end affirmative action for women. Now, don't be fooled here. This, of course, is something that the men's rights movement supports, but for two very different reasons. This woman wants to be able to encourage other women to essentially sit at home on their asses and do nothing. And, you know, if women can't benefit from affirmative action, they'll be a lot more likely to do so. If affirmative action for women was struck down today, we'd all know that there would be a lot of women looking for men to pay their meal ticket, you know, pretending to submit and all that, you know, kind of all those kind of traditionalist catchphrases. The next stated goal, reinstate the husband as legal head of the household with authority to make final decisions regarding the finances and where the family will live. She, of course, leaves out that this only applies, you know, during the marriage. In the event of divorce, it's quite clear what she wants to happen with your monies when that process is going forth. Here's another one. Encourage women to refrain from sexual activities until the male commits to marry and provide for her. Now, you know, is this the type of women that you want to pair up with? And this shows the manipulative nature of the traditionalist woman who uses sex as a weapon. She's essentially saying, if you don't do what I want, you won't get access to sex. You know, and so she's essentially basically telling you that I'm not with you because I like you, because, you know, I think that you're attractive or I like your personality or what have you. She's essentially saying, I'm with you because I need you to pay my meal ticket. And if you refuse to do so, then I will use sex as a form of extortion against you. And the last stated goal here, and this is definitely one of the most telling, reinstating common law rights for women that were repealed in the name of equality, such as her right to recover damages for breach of promise to marry and seduction. So, in other words, if you suppose, quote, seduce a woman and she's somehow under the impression that you're going to marry her, she wants to be able to sue you, basically, to extract monies from you for, you know, the promise of marriage. You know, forget about the fact that sometimes people could say they want to go into the marriage and change their mind later on. She wants women to be able to sue men, you know, for breach of promise of marriage. You know, these people, you know, these are not our friends, gentlemen. The goal is, of course, to maximize the amount of male utility for the cheapest amount possible for a host of differing interests, not one of which includes those of the average everyday man. This is not in the physical sense comparable to the rape of a woman, but in the overarching sense of it being an attack on the great male equalizer in this reproductive struggle. It is, in fact, a form of subtle rape. I'll call it soft rape. It's an attack on the sexual autonomy of men. It's the confiscation of his sexual bargaining chip, and so is child support. It all boils down to the lie that mothers are somehow capable of rendering a better quality of care by virtue of their femaleness on anything other than a very basic physiological level. Now, the reality that a woman can breastfeed, for example, and a man can't, is a reality I don't deny, but to hold this up as some sort of proof that women are better equipped in any significant, developmentally altering way in raising of children is not true at all. Men can nurture young children as well as any woman can, and not only can we nurture them as well, but if the negative effects of single motherhood are any indication, men have a superior ability to instill order and discipline in adolescent males and females alike. Alimony must be defined, better yet ingrained into the minds of young boys as being a societal mechanism for enslaving them. They must be taught that marriage is the vector for this enslavement, and they must be taught that this idea that it is a man's job to support a woman is an attack on his very maleness, that the decision to provide for a woman if he so chooses is one that should be made privately between two adult consenting parties, regardless of what society expects of him as a man. This is the only acceptable context in which a man or a boy should feel it is okay to provide for a female. Everything else should be viewed as nothing more than a hostile attack on his male sovereignty. We need to teach boys about the pitfalls of the legal system from an early age, particularly that there is a state of affairs in America, specifically that functions as a meat grinder, a processor of male utility where a man can be forcefully employed against his will to work in a modern-day wage slavery bunker, if you will, for 19 cents an hour. Now, the standing federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour gives us the stark reality that men earning these prison wages are receiving, what, a minuscule 2.6% of the current federal minimum wage. It's essentially legalized slave labor. And if you consider the fact that men are more likely to be imprisoned and serve longer jail sentences than women, and that they're also more likely to serve more time for the same sentences, again, it becomes quite clear that it's a way of capitalizing on a man's most precious asset, the only one that can compete with the value of female reproductive ability, that is, his utility. War is another vehicle for the deprivation of male utility. It essentially conscripts a man's body as a weapon of war for the protection of the female collective, who of course is tucked nicely into the inner recesses of society where harm is much less likely. Now, in a country such as America, where the total financial military expenditures outpace any other competition by a huge margin, the average starting base pay for an entry-level private can be as low as $17,000 a year, whilst the average per capita income in the US fluctuates at around $40,000 a year. Now, nobody denies that a military is essential to the national security of a nation, but what we have here in the American male soldier is essentially a tool who is being used to wage war on other men for interests he'll probably never discern for himself and for wages that can barely be said to approach any measure of self-sufficiency. Boys must be instructed to see military service as at best a necessary evil to be engaged in only when he is absolutely convinced that not doing so will pose an imminent danger to him and his countrymen and his family, and at worst it should be looked at as an exploitative conscription expected only of men, where men don't, you know, accelerate their lives or, you know, become an army of one or whatever other bullshit feel-good appeal to masculinity the military PR agencies gin up, but where men die voluntarily at the hands of other men. We need to teach men that they are better than a piece of meat forged as a weapon of war to kill other men. We need to tap back into the survival instinct of men, and we need to make men feel almost ashamed to serve in the military. Now, I'm not saying every war is unjust or unwarranted, but men should view any effort on their part to fight for nations and institutions against other men as, at best, a deeply saddening, albeit sometimes necessary action, but never the supposedly masculine violence glorification orgy that we see today. It shouldn't be cool or manly to allow yourself to be used as a weapon of war. It should be shunned, viewed almost as a cop-out or as a last resort. War isn't cool, folks. You understand that? War is violence and death and blood. There's nothing manly about it. It's time we let men fight for what they actually believe in. Not for a flag and not for a country, but for him and those important to him, whoever they may be. And taking that into account, men must be taught to be extremely selective towards who they would risk their lives for. It is imperative that we begin to emulate women in terms of their obsession with their health. Now again, the concept of utility applies here. Men are simply terrified of not being useful to women. What potential to protect and provide can you offer if you're not healthy enough to protect and provide for yourself? The paradox, of course, is that the more you strive to render that provision, the unhealthier you'll be. Let's face it, prolonged periods of providing for not only yourself, but other family members is a prescription for higher amounts of stress, less free time devoted to leisure or hobby, less free time devoted to exercise, diet, and overall health. So the more we teach men to conserve and build their wealth, the more we instill a cold, callous approach to the dispensing of the fruits of their labors to rival the unceasing Kelvin scale cold that women exhibit towards who they will dole out their reproductive services to, the more we can, of course, expect to see an increase in male health and life expectancy based solely off the fact that men will have had to have worked less to, quote, provide for the useless, you know, plasticky, extraneous bullshit that takes the female collective's materialistic fancy in any given year, or day, or month. With that said, though, men still, bottom line, and to be as frank as possible, would rather let their health problems coalesce and build until it grows much, much worse. Men are still more likely to avoid the doctor than women, and that's a choice. You know, that's a flaw within us. That's something that we are responsible for. The more women's obsession with their health looks unreasonable to your male mind, the more you should strive to emulate it. Now, I have what can only be described as a borderline overzealous relationship with my doctor. If I sneeze the wrong way, I go to my doctor. And you know where I learned that from? I learned it from women. And men need to learn it too. We need to educate males from boyhood about the prostate, about testosterone, about the things that make them male. We need to show a willingness to spend money on research into optimum male health and diet and exercise regimens. We need to demand, absolutely, that any government dollars spent on healthcare will be spent on men as much as women. We need to aggressively pursue scientific study into cancers of the prostate, testicular cancer, and any and all other male-specific diseases or disorders. We, meaning men, need to re-enter, this is key, we need to re-enter the discussion on male mental health by any means necessary. Now, because of the whole Sandy Hook thing, there's a huge debate going on about male mental health, and almost all of the discussion is taking place within a context of blame and stigmatization of men, and particularly boys. We need to push our way, militantly if need be, into academia on all levels and demand that men be allowed access to boys in education, period. We need to fight to get them away from the system that women and feminists exist in. And we need to reconnect them with the presence of masculinity from the very earliest ages. And the fact is that they have failed boys miserably. I would go as far as to say that the amount to which these women have failed boys, and yes, I'm making a prejudicial statement about female educators, deal with it or unsubscribe, that the amount to which these women have failed boys is borderline criminal. And what they've done essentially is to rob boys of their destiny because they don't learn the pathetic way that women do. You know, they fidget, they clamor, they explore, they discover, and that, they said, was a mental health, quote, problem. And they proceeded then to medicate away everything good about boys because they just didn't care. They just didn't give a fuck. Well, if female educators can't protect boys, then men will have to step in and do it militantly until the issue is resolved. And by the way, serotonin reuptake inhibitors are not a resolution under any context at all, full stop. I mean, let's actually discuss the details here, especially in terms of these serotonin reuptake inhibitors that are being prescribed to boys, because we have to put into context what's actually going on here, just in case there's any confusion as to what the actual crime that took place really is. We're dealing with a mass miseducation of boys. We do know that serotonin reuptake inhibitors have a mechanism of action where the reuptake channels of neurosynaptic junctions are blocked because a drug such as Prozac or Luvox or whatever does not allow the nerve issuing the neurotransmitters to take them back afterwards. The human brain, of course, is known for its propensity not towards being a static physiological organ, but as an organ of change in neuronal plasticity. So with enough external biochemical manipulation, the brain will learn that the patient taking these medications is, for whatever reason, pursuing increased serotonergic activity. The brain naturally seeks to curb this excess, presynaptic neurons sending the message excrete less serotonin, postsynaptic neurons receiving the message constrict the serotonin receptors receiving it. And so in prescribing these medications to our young boys, we literally are hampering their ability to feel happiness as a normal person should. The phenomena is described scientifically as tardive dysphoria. And there's a very interesting link in the low bar for those of you who want to get more acquainted with that term. But basically, it means that prolonged ingestion of these serotonin reuptake inhibitors cause depressive symptoms so severe that normal approaches, including the consumption of these SSRI drugs, no longer have any perceivable effect on depression. And this was all under the auspices of the supposedly more nurturing gender, you know. We're talking about the soccer moms who insist that daddy work to pay the bills, but trust some, you know, school psychologist to his and her own son's mental well-being to the point where she allows him to be drugged. Again, this is all because we're instructing boys under predominantly female teachers who don't understand how they learn and quite frankly can't understand how they learn. And this isn't fully feminism here. You know, although without a doubt, feminists rejoice at the fact that young boys are being put on these medications. The invention of Prozac didn't come around until the late 1980s and was only beginning to be prescribed on a massive scale during the mid-90s. So this situation derived not from feminism, but from the false notion that women are more nurturing and thus better suited than men are to teach children at the elementary level and even at the preliminary adolescent levels when many of the so-called behavioral problems associated with male learning occur. In other words, the female saturation that boys are confronted with are a manifestation of the veneration of motherhood, the divine feminism, which has its roots in traditionalist constructs and customs. So again, what's needed here is an aggressive, culturally militant push on the part of men who give a fuck about boys, you know, not restoring the family, not repairing gender relations, but men that actually care about boys, forcing their way back into the school systems, armed with studies highlighting gender differences in adolescent boys and girls, showing that we do in fact learn differently and that we want men who understand boys to teach boys. Look at a picture of Albert Einstein's desk here. Do you see deadlines here? Or do you see any neat, ordered, structured female learning here? You see any papers handed in all neat and nice that say exactly what the teacher wants to hear on this desk? No, it's just cluttered, adventurous brilliance. Men who understand boys don't tell boys that the speed of gravity accelerates an object at 9.8 meters squared towards the Earth. They get a strobe light. They get a board with equally spaced black and white strips. They record something falling through these equally spaced strips, and they literally show them with stopwatches and with superimpositions of the images that the object is in fact accelerating towards Earth, that the object is in fact clearing these equally spaced black and white strips at a faster rate when it's closer to the Earth than when it started falling originally. That's how boys learn. Let female teachers teach their rote learning memorized garbage to girls if it's so damn effective. That's not good enough for boys, and they deserve much better. You know, I bet you then we'll see a huge decrease in the so-called mental health problems that boys are facing when this kind of education is implemented. The graphic you're seeing is just unacceptable. If need be, we're going to have to push for gender-segregated schooling. Anything to ensure that boys and men are once again able to have contact away from women and in the presence of masculinity in the educative process. Now, finally, as a way of attempting to jumpstart or extending a new approach to an overall feeling of stagnation within particularly the men's rights portion of the manosphere, which others have suggested to me, and I'd be inclined to agree, is plagued by overzealous self-policing and an inordinate amount of talk about repairing relations between men and women instead of securing freedom and prosperity for all men and boys, be they single or otherwise, and other ineffective doctrines. In hopes of mitigating this, I'm going to be discussing how this oversensitivity towards being perceived as misogynist has essentially stopped the men's movement directly in its tracks, entrapping it in a tiger's pit of back and forth with feminist trolls, you know, Fitrell and the like, where all that's ever discussed by MRAs is, quote, you know, I'm not a misogynist, you're a misandrist. And the feminist, of course, will rebut with, misandry isn't real, silly, you're a misogynist, repeat ad infinitum and nothing ever gets done, ever. So, with that said, I maintain that the men's movement is a strictly non-violent movement. We do not advocate violence as a method of achieving our objectives. So to adhere to this, we need to be non-violent in our methods and actions, which leaves us nonetheless in a position of war, but in a metaphorical war, a war of words fought on the theater of perception. And on this battlefield, any soldier that appeals to the sensibilities of the general public in too extreme a fashion has his weapons instantly malfunction on him. It's a parameter of this theater of war born out of the fact that our society is set up to fear extremes, even when extremes are perfectly justifiable and rational in response to embedded extremes that have been normalized on this battlefield where perception is war and victory. So very well, let's test the limits of your aversion to all things extreme. Barbarossa calls up the New York issuer of Marriage Licensees for an inquiry. Now, he asks the person who answers if she could be so kind as to explain to him the process of how one would go about obtaining a marriage license for the purposes of elopement, and in doing so is particularly specific about whether or not, at any point in the process, in the transition from being single to married, is it mentioned that upon making this status transition, one's assets and properties are explicitly defined as being now split between the two parties in marriage. She answers that no such stipulation is mentioned, and it then dawns upon Barbarossa that upon entering into one of these marriage contracts, a man unknowingly signs away his wealth and property to a woman without giving written consent. A de facto divorce protocol has been agreed to, divorce proceedings in the event are simply after the fact details. Barbarossa then realizes that it could very well have been him had he not discovered the men's movement who would have married into one of these situations, and thus it could also very well have been him who would, upon his divorce, be forced into a form of modernized slavery where my paycheck, the manifestation of my labor, would be garnished for the purposes of paying alimony to a woman who had no misgivings about visiting this legalized slavery on my person. Now, Barbarossa knows himself very well, and he knows that he hates violence, and he knows that he'll go to great lengths to avoid it. And yet, you know, a part of him cannot shake the nagging suspicion that if he ever found himself enslaved in such a manner, well, let's just stop there and say that Barbarossa isn't getting married. If you're a visual listener to any degree, then hopefully that little digression painted the proper picture in your mind. Now, I took you to the precipice of extremism, the place where no one wishes to go because, in the end, this entire so-called movement is predicated on not sounding extreme. So I took you to an extreme. I let you peer over the edge to satiate your obsession, not because I want you to embrace that extreme, but because I want you to know what it looks like and calmly, without fear, understand why you naturally don't wish to be there. I don't pretend that the extreme is a place I want to be, but I also don't pretend that without access to the proper education, I couldn't have ended up there myself. Now, if these people in the men's movement had any real interest in stopping misogyny, they would ask themselves why feelings of hatred might manifest within men, particularly men that have been through a nasty divorce, or that have had their children stripped away from them. Instead, they simply, like has been the status quo for millennia, try to ostracize and marginalize these men simply for experiencing the full range of human emotion. That is, happiness, joy, fear, confusion, anger, and yes, even hatred. They go on and on telling us that feminism is hatred against men, and then when women use the power feminism has granted them, they do nothing but spit on the men when they exhibit the same hatred back. It's actually a subtle form of male dehumanization. Women hate because of feminism. Feminists hate because of feminism. But men, you see, men hate because they have somehow failed with women. It's their fault. It's the same old pussy pass bullshit. Now, if you agree with me that alimony or child support or being thrown in jail for child support non-payment or alimony non-payment is a form of modern-day slavery, we have to ask ourselves, who then is the slave and who is the slave owner? Well, we know that a man making alimony payments upon the annulment of a marriage in which he never explicitly or contractually agreed to render these payments upon said annulment is in fact enslaved. The woman who walked into the divorce office is in fact the slave owner. Now, as in early American slavery, there is a slave, there is a slave master, and there is a legal climate that allows the enslavement of others. As with American slavery, there was nothing illegal about owning slaves. There is nothing illegal today with forcing someone to give up the fruits of their labor under threat of jail time to a woman one was once married to. Are there noted differences between early American enslavement of Africans and the enslavement of men via alimony in modernity? Absolutely. Nobody denies this, and yet how can one deny the similarities? My videos have shown you, have proven to you that, for example, if you don't, or more importantly, can't pay your child support because you simply don't have the money, you can be imprisoned, locked in a cage. There are men, today, right now, who can't pay child support because they couldn't pay alimony, and some of those men are in jail as I speak. So, to revisit early American slavery and to reiterate, we have a slave, we have a slave master, and we have a legal climate tolerant of a form of enslavement. An African man enslaved in America saw a slave master, which he worked under, tell him, you know, go pick me some cotton, boy. You know, go break your back, boy. You better work or hang, boy. And that slave master reminded him every day, psychologically, that his destiny was being deprived of him. His freedom was being stolen. Every day he was reminded of this by the presence of his slave master. So I'll ask you a question then. Is it surprising that he would hate his slave master? Is it possible that he would see that all of his people, or more importantly, all of the people that looked just like him, were enslaved by white slave masters? Would it be shocking to you that he would develop hatred towards white people? Would you treat him as though it was a character deficiency on his part that he developed this hatred? Nonsense. The actions of the slave master would be a pretty damn good explanation for the development of that hatred now, wouldn't it? Let's say the enslavement was reversed. Let's say all slave masters are now black. All slaves are now white. Would a white slave be abnormal or bitter or only angry because he couldn't earn the approval of black people? My point? Sometimes hatred is earned. It doesn't make it any more healthy for the person experiencing it, but sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes, groups of people behave in such a way and in such large numbers that groups of people affected negatively by the original group's actions begin to develop a collective hatred. Hatred, after all, is there for a reason. It exists for a good damn reason. Women hate, and so do men. And some men, just like some women, hate for a good damn reason. Some men have a woman in their life that used a completely legal process to literally enslave him. Some men see a great many women doing this, and they begin to hate women just like the slave eventually develops hatred for the people enslaving him. Now, looking back on this, when men actually achieve full equality under the law, and when alimony is looked at as it should be, that is, a means of enslaving people, I don't want to be the person that is remembered for telling men, yeah, you know, you've been enslaved, but don't be bitter, you know, don't be angry, you know, because God forbid the people doing the enslaving be subject to some actual scorn or hatred. These people in our movement that harp on about misogyny, have you ever been taken to the cleaners in divorce court? Have you ever been deprived of your children and your money or your freedom? Have you? No? Okay, so shut the fuck up, and how about you allow the men undergoing this the full range of human emotion? How about you stop telling these people what they're allowed to feel? How about you wait until your paycheck gets garnished before you even see it to go to some female so she can stay in your former house and fuck her new boyfriend while you don't even know if you're going to be homeless in a week? Yes, it happens a hell of a lot more than you think. And if you've gone through that, then you can come on your little high horse and tell men to check their misogyny. You know, go through the divorce court, get fucked over, pay attention to the gender that's doing the vast amount of fucking over, and the gender that's getting fucked, and then lecture us on how and why hatred is so damn bad for us, you sanctimonious hypocrites. Hate doesn't come out of nowhere, people. It exists as a defense mechanism. Sometimes it is there to remind you that this person or these persons could very well make your life a living hell. Be suspicious of them. They've earned it. The divorces, you know, the way women have used children as bargaining chips to be leveraged against men, the way they've stolen male wealth, you think that eventually some men wouldn't succumb to the allure of hatred after 50 years of this constant barrage? Like early American slavery, the fact that alimony was and still is legal should, by definition, produce some hatred of women and men having their wealth stolen from them. It's a simple product of human behavior. Feminism is the overarching tolerance of a profoundly evil ideology. Each slave is affected by the wider legality of feminism, but each slave also has a slave master that he has to see every day that forces him against his will by falling back on the profoundly evil yet legal forces of feminism to provide to her a quality of life she would not be able to provide without access to the fruits of his labors. If the same amount of men were divorcing women in the same numbers, you know, getting them locked up, accusing them of crimes they didn't commit, you think that some women wouldn't be developing hatred for men? Now, I don't condone hatred against women, but I'm certainly not one of these people that are going to treat you like some damn fucking leper if you do. You know, instead of these people who purport to care about men and then go ahead and label you a misogynist, just like some card-carrying feminist if you're having trouble not letting, you know, these feelings develop into hatred, I'm not going to label you and I'm not going to spit on you or attempt to ostracize you. What I'm going to do is to help you channel that into something that benefits men and yourself. These guys who care more about, you know, proving to feminists that we don't hate women than they do about helping men that have been so marginalized and attacked that they just don't know how else to react but to hate women, fuck those guys. You know, I'm not going to reject you. I'm going to show you how to simply stop giving a damn
and begin worrying about yourself. And once you do that, once you can finally just let go, you'll see. You'll never hate anybody ever again. So, you know, I've been talking for a while now. This video is probably at least over an hour. So I'm going to stop it right here. And further videos to come in the future. I apologize for the length of this video, but I really feel that I had to get a comprehensive encapsulation of all the ideas that I've been talking about recently with a couple new concepts added in. So if you enjoyed, please subscribe. Thank you for listening.